Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crinoid Podcast number 9, The Ark in Space.
It's an amazing sight, isn't it? The entire human race in one room. All colours, all creeds, all differences finally forgotten.
Doctor, are you serious? The entire human race?
Well, its chosen descendants. The operation must have been meticulously planned. Come on.
Where are we going now?
First to find Sarah. And we're going to shut down the systems where intruders here, you know.
Just a minute, Doctor. Are you trying to tell me that this is where it's all going to end, in here?
Not end, Harry. Just a pause.
But there's only a few hundred bodies in here. I mean, what's happened to the rest of humanity? Some global catastrophe?
Yes. And they saw it coming and made provision for it as best they could.
I have with me on the end of a Skype line, as ever, Martin.
Hello, Jim.
Hello, Martin. Are you well?
All right. How are you?
Existing, thanks. Without further ado, let's crack on into some feedback. As you may remember, in Crinoid Podcast number 8, we looked at the Visitation, Peter Davison's story in his first season. A regular contributor and loyal listener, Wayne Peters, has given us some thoughts of what he thought of the Visitation, and here they are. He says, I've not watched this one for many years. My strongest memory is being really upset that they destroyed the Sonic. Peter Davison's plaintive cry that they've killed an old friend summed it up nicely, I think. It felt like the last remnants of Tom Baker finally swept away. Of course, these days, I'd gladly see the thing thrown into the fires of Moria, but there we go. Well, I think we agree with that, don't we, Martin?
Definitely.
They did actually destroy Tenant Sonic in the Daleks in Manhattan, which made me shout, yay! But he replaced it with an exact copy. Boom. As a kid, I loved the idea that it was the Doctor that caused the fire of London. It was great when the Doctor interacted with real-world events because it made the show seem more real. I find I still prefer historical stories to pure sci-fi ones. I remember thinking that the Pteroleptors were quite a cool design, though not a patch on the Zygons. And at the time, that the actor that played Richard Mace would have made a terrific Doctor. Shame he apparently hated it. I was equally surprised when you said that allegedly the cast didn't get on with Matthew Waterhouse. Or did I mishear that bit? That was news to me. Martin, you know a bit about that, don't you?
Do I?
You're the one who mentioned it on the podcast, Martin, so I thought I'd throw it over to you.
Well, if you hear any of the cast talking about it on Big Finish interviews or on the commentaries on the DVDs, they probably don't overtly say it, but it's quite clear to me that they thought he was a bit of a git, to be honest.
Well, I mean, I did listen to most of the commentary on the Visitation DVD, and of course Matthew Waterhouse is on there, and that description doesn't sound a million miles away from the truth.
I think also quite often he will be doing his commentaries on his own, which is quite telling as well.
Maybe it was after the Visitation when they decided no one wanted to do it with him anymore. Yeah, not instantly likeable, put it that way. But enough of the character assassination. Thanks to Wayne Peters for that review and the Visitation. We had some input from Draculasaurus a couple of podcasts ago, who has some of his artwork on DeviantArt.com. Wayne Peters also does. Obviously, an artistic, talented bunch. Listen to his podcast, Martin. We expected nothing less. Wayne has his pages at Scarecrow. That's Scarecrow with two V's instead of a W. scarecrow.deviantart.com, and there's some rather splendid artwork there for you to feast your eyes upon. So, on to the Ark in Space. Martin, would you like to give us a bit of context on this story?
I would love to, yes. This is the Ark in Space, Tom Baker's second story from 1975. It was broadcast January to February 1975, recorded the year before. It's the first fully Philip Hinchcliffe-produced story, because I think Robot was still Barry Letts, wasn't it? I think it was recorded third in the production run. They recorded Sontaran Experiment before this, and you can actually tell a little from Tom Baker's performance that he'd broken his collarbone before, which he did during the filming of Sontaran Experiment.
Ouch.
I think it's quite clear that it's a very different style to Barry Letts, but we'll probably pick up on that as we go through.
Yeah.
You know, back in the mid-70s, classic Who, so let's get on with it, eh?
Yeah, let's indeed. They start off with one of the best title sequences in the show's history, if not the best. But on this occasion, they've put a kind of strange pink and green tint onto the title sequence. I must admit, I thought there was something up with the DVD at first, until I saw the info notes on the DVD where they actually explained that they did this as a little experiment and never repeated it, not even for the rest of this particular story. It's literally just for episode one of Mark in Space.
Yeah.
But yeah, it gives a kind of faintly sort of sepia feel, which is peculiar, and it didn't really work.
Had you actually noticed that before watching it this time?
No, never.
I've watched this story, you know, many times, and I'd never ever noticed it. And it was only because it was kind of pointed out in the info text that, oh, yeah.
I actually noticed it this time, but I'd never noticed it before. But it was good to see an explanation of it. I mean, this was repeated, wasn't it, back in the 70s, as a single story with no breaks, wasn't it? They edited it down to, I think, to about 70 minutes or something. So they may have fiddled with the opening sequence then.
Mm.
Sometimes they go back right to the original broadcast format, don't they, when they do a DVD. So I wonder if they've done it this time, but hadn't done it for the VHS release, say.
Possibly, yeah.
And then we get to, unfortunately, it's a rather poor, wobbly shot of the Ark hanging in space, which is a big space station wobbling about alarmingly in space.
Yeah, it's not fantastic.
But interestingly, on the DVD, they do have some CGI reconstructions of the space scenes, don't they? But they were done a number of years ago, and they already look dated, don't they?
Yeah, it's strange when they do that on the DVDs. I mean, I guess it's interesting. You can watch it with the new effects, but I don't tend to, because it would spoil the fun.
Exactly. I wonder if it's if people are trying to turn other people onto the show and they're a bit embarrassed about the effects, so I might show that version to them.
Mm.
Not too much to be embarrassed about on this particular story, I don't think.
You then get Wirren eye view, don't you, of this creature walking around on the Ark. The camera's got like a green filter on it with a hole in the middle, which presumably is supposed to be the eye of the Wirren. It walks towards who we later find out to be June. What is he? He's the power technician, isn't he?
That's right, yeah.
So, yeah, quite an eerie opening shot. He's cut behind this plastic casket thing, and the door has opened. And I think, unfortunately, he's blinking a bit, isn't he?
His animation doesn't seem to be completely suspended, does it? But never mind.
Then we cut to the TARDIS arriving in a kind of a dark corner of a room on this, turns out to be a space station. Interestingly, it doesn't materialise. It's already kind of there, isn't it? It's just in shadow.
Yeah, the light's flashing and it's in shadow, isn't it? And it makes the materialisation noise, but you know, it's in the shot from the beginning, isn't it?
Mm. Presumably they couldn't be asked to do the filter shot.
Perhaps.
And it opens with the cracking line from Tom Baker to poor old Harry. You're a clumsy, ham-fisted idiot.
Yes.
You know, I know a few of those, Jim.
Well, I know at least one. Harry's been fiddling with the helmet regulator on the TARDIS console.
Yeah, you should never do that.
No, that's just a schoolboy error. Along with the pure horror of this story, there is it is leavened by moments of humour, and most of those are at Harry Sullivan's expense.
They are, yeah.
We should say, to anyone not familiar, Harry Sullivan is
an idiot.
He's an idiot, yes. He's also a military surgeon, isn't he, or doctor, who's been consigned to look after the doctor after his regeneration, isn't he? Just to make sure he's okay and give him a few checkups and stuff. And he ends up, because he doesn't believe the TARDIS works, the doctor decides to take him on a short trip to the moon, doesn't he? And of course, Harry fiddles with his helmet regulator, as he fiddles with controls quite a lot, doesn't he? And they end up thousands of years into the future and nowhere near the moon.
Mm.
Well, I suppose fairly near the moon, but certainly nowhere near current day.
Exactly. The other member of the team is, of course, Sarah Jane Smith. And they start to have a kind of look around. It's fairly dark and dingy. Doctor thinks there's not much oxygen. And he does a gravity reading with his yo-yo, which I think is quite good.
Textbook.
He manages to find the lights and turns them on, and they appear to be in some sort of control room.
Yeah, the Doctor believes they're on an artificial satellite, doesn't he, as a result of his yo-yo reading?
Yeah. Sarah manages to open a door to another room while the Doctor and Harry are kind of...
Harry opens it, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah, Harry does. Of course he does. Inadvertently, Harry opens the door, and Sarah goes in and gets shut in there. So, you know, immediately, within minutes of the episode starting, they've got split up in classic Who style.
The room Sarah's in appears to be even lower on oxygen, doesn't it, than the rest of the bit they've been exploring?
Yes, and she starts to call out to them, doesn't she?
It's one of those moments, isn't it, where when the door opens, she calls to the Doctor, and... throughout the show's history, and not just this show either, other programs and films, just at the wrong moment, someone will decide they're too busy looking at what they're looking at and aren't interested in what anyone else is looking at. So the Doctor does the Not Now, Sarah routine.
Mm.
And, of course, she then gets trapped, and it takes a little while for them to find out what's up.
Meanwhile, the Doctor's sort of trying to work out where they are, and he's having a look at the controls in this control room, and he decides that they were probably made in the 29th or 30th century, but they're well beyond that.
There's a great interchange with Harry here, isn't there?
Yeah.
When the Doctor says, the technology is around the 30th century, and Harry says, oh, no. And the Doctor looks at him and says, what, you don't agree?
Yeah.
It's great. So, and they also, there's a little in-joke, isn't there? The Doctor talks about a Bennett oscillator. The director of this story is Rodney Bennett, whose name was familiar to me back in the 70s. It was the rival school in Grange Hill. It was called Rodney Bennett School.
Maybe that too was named after him.
Maybe it was. Maybe it was. Yeah, so it's obviously far-flung future technology, but it also appears to be thousands of years old at the time that TARDIS travellers are there. So this is very far-flung future.
Mm. Then they realise that Sarah's not there, and they're kind of looking around trying to find out where she's got to. And the Doctor thinks that there's an hermetically sealed door, doesn't he?
Mm. The Doctor says, you haven't touched anything, have you, Harry? He says, me? And the Doctor says, well, there are only two of us here, and your name is Harry.
That's right, which is brilliant. And then, of course, Harry had touched something, but absolutely nothing happened.
Yeah.
So the Doctor's frantically telling him to try to remember which one he's pressed.
There's an interesting moment just before this where they're wondering whether Sarah's gone into the TARDIS as they can't find her. And the Doctor says she can't be, as he's got the only key. But if you look at the TARDIS, the doors appear to be ajar, so a key would not be necessary then.
Schoolboy error. Mm. Harry eventually remembers which switch it was, and they open the door. And of course, Sarah's there unconscious. They make the mistake of going in, and the door closes behind them as well. Which is a bit daft.
Yeah, it's a comedy of errors so far, isn't it?
Yeah.
A great line from Harry saying that he hates sliding doors ever since he got his nose caught in one in Pompey Barracks.
Yeah.
It's all adding to Harry's kind of clumsy persona, but it must be almost impossible to get your nose caught in a sliding door.
Well, if it is possible, I'm sure Harry's perfectly capable of doing it.
Well, maybe he is, isn't he?
The Doctor sort of goes over to the controls and he finds the oxygen supply, but it's not working, and nothing seems to be working in the room. And he opens a kind of a panel and finds the wires have been severed. He thinks maybe they've been bitten through. And, of course, he starts to think about how's he going to repair them. And, of course, he uses his sonic screwdriver to do so.
Of course.
Which in those days was probably a bit of a novelty.
Yeah, he didn't see that much of it back then, did you?
No. Just in time, he manages to get the oxygen going, and Harry and Sarah start to recover, having fallen unconscious. It's interesting, as the Doctor's doing it, he's kind of half passing out himself, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. We find out, I think, later, don't we, he's got a respiratory bypass, isn't he? Isn't the Terror of Zygons?
Mm.
So, he's still feeling the effects, though, and it's quite nicely acted, isn't it, Tom Baker? Looks a bit sort of dazed, and he can't really sort of focus on the screwdriver when he drops it.
Mm. Harry's fully recovered, and he picks Sarah up and puts her on a convenient couch nearby. Amusingly, he's holding down her skirt just to protect her modesty, isn't he? Throughout the story, Harry refers to her as old girl, doesn't he?
Mm.
And Sarah sort of starts to come round and says, call me old girl again and I'll spit in your eye.
Yeah, it's a nice relationship those two have. It's before the days of romance in Doctor Who, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they rub along okay, don't they? But he sort of inadvertently annoys her quite a lot, and she won't have that.
No.
And so there's a bit of bickering, isn't there? But interesting and amusing bickering rather than sort of tedious and annoying bickering.
Yeah.
Sarah's reviving, and the Doctor and Harry go to the TARDIS to get some brandy. Good to know that the Doctor's a well-stocked drinks cabinet in the TARDIS. Mm. But as they go out, a strange piece of machinery drops down from the ceiling and shoots at them. And it turns out to be an auto-guard security device. And Harry's shoe gets utterly destroyed, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of fires electricity at them, doesn't it?
Mm.
They kind of dive behind this desk, to get out of the way. Meanwhile, in the other room, Sarah sort of calls out to them. but then appears to become kind of mesmerized by something and falls back onto this sort of couch thing and then vanishes into thin air.
Mm, incredible. Yeah, a few lights start flashing, don't they, around the bed, and then she's off. Meanwhile, back under the desk, the doctor has an aerial, doesn't he? And he pops his hat on it and lifts it above the desk, and he gets immediately incinerated by this auto gun.
That's a good effect, that, actually.
Yeah, it looks really good, yeah.
How they did it, but it, you know, you get all these sort of bits of, you know, hat falling around them, and, you know, frantically trying to kind of put out the fire kind of thing.
Yes, it's stamping it, trying to smother it. Doctor then realises that this auto guard was activated when he made those repairs, so he kind of reasons that may well be the reason that the sabotage happened in the first place, was to deactivate this auto guard.
Mm. So Sarah's kind of been transported to another part of the space station, and she's on, it's referred to as a tranquilla couch, and you hear this voice speaking to her, welcoming her to Nerva, which is obviously the name of this station. And it's talking about the final phase of processing, et cetera, et cetera. It's obviously doing something to her. We're not quite sure yet what it is.
Yeah, this voice mentions some biocryonic vibrations, doesn't it? And that this processing, whatever it is radiation-based, isn't it?
Mm.
But all the while, there's some Handel playing gently in the background.
Yeah. And then the voice, it's a female voice, isn't it? And it says you will shortly hear recorded voice, the High Minister, which is, yeah, it's all very strange. Don't really know what's going on at the minute.
Mm, yeah, it's quite, it's all quite unnerving, isn't it? Unnerving events on Nerva.
Mm.
Yes, back under the table, the doctor waves the aerial on its own and realises, even though it's flapping about, the auto guard's not shooting at it. So he then sort of surmises that it's programmed to shoot at organic objects.
Mm.
He then decides that, you know, they can move the kind of cover they're under. So he actually uses a sonic screwdriver to unscrew something. You know, the nuts are holding this table to the floor. And, yeah, it's quite a nice effect when you see these things kind of remotely unscrewing themselves.
Mm. Back to Sarah, who is being spoken to by this High Minister. And things start to take a more sinister turn when she talks about making the supreme sacrifice.
Doesn't sound good, does it?
Yeah, and Sarah starts to panic a bit, doesn't she? But then this tranquilla couch kicks back in and she sort of falls back again down to the couch.
Yeah, that's right. So she's kind of incapacitated, isn't she? Back in the next room, the Doctor and Harry are shuffling this desk around the room so that they can get around without being shot at. They get all the way to the controller. The Doctor's work out is the controller will cut out the auto guard, but it's fairly high up on the wall and they can't reach it from their covers. The Doctor tries to pull the switch down by looping his scarf over it, and his scarf gets basically cut in half, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Harry says that if he had a cricket ball, he could jolly well move that lever, and the Doctor fishes out of his voluminous pockets a cricket ball and says, "Will this do?" Unfortunately, that gets absolutely atomised, doesn't it, when Harry tries to throw it at his controls. Haven't got anywhere.
The thought has just occurred to me, actually, about this whole scene. Why would the switch be there? Got this auto guard that will shoot at anything organic, and you've got an on-off switch. Who would be turning the switch on and off? Because surely if you turn the switch on, that'd be the end of you.
Yeah, you'd think the control would not be in the same room, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that doesn't quite add up, does it, really?
Yes, I think you call that dramatic license, that one.
Mm, and so you've got some sort of robot that will come in and do it for you, but... It seems a bit strange to have an on-off switch in the room with this lethal auto guard.
Yeah, terrible design fault. Of course, Harry's got one shoe left, having everyone destroyed by the auto guard, and he chucks it across the room as a diversion while the Doctor jumps up and pulls the lever. Of course, Harry's other shoe gets destroyed, but the auto guard is disabled. Harry spends the rest of the story wandering around in socks, doesn't he?
Mm. I love it when you know they pop their heads up from behind the desks, and you get the Doctor's boggly eyes, and then he breaks into his trademark grin. It's great.
Massive grin. He also reveals that his scarf was knitted by Madame Nostradamus.
Mm. A witty little knitter.
Yes.
Yeah, and Harry's bemoaning his shoes, isn't he? Meanwhile, Sarah is comatose on this couch thing, and the scream sort of comes down, trapping Sarah inside, and then a kind of a vapour starts to surround her.
Dry ice gets pumped in, doesn't it? And I wonder why the soundtrack didn't change to Black Sabbath instead of Handel.
Yeah, Meanwhile, back in the other room, the Doctor and Harry go through to... Actually, they call out to Sarah to say, oh, you know, you can come out now. But obviously, she's not there anymore. So they go in there and they realise that this thing they put her on is actually a short-range matter transmitter. So they think, well, you know, it's only short-range. She must be somewhere else on this spaceship. So they go off looking for her. And they go out into one of these corridors that go around kind of the outside of the Ark. I quite like the effect here, really. It's very stark, isn't it? And you get the backdrop is kind of space and stars, isn't it? I think it's reasonably okay. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it works really well. They tend to get the most out of the piece of corridor, don't they? Because it gets shot from different angles and gets used quite a lot during the course of the story. But yeah, it looks really good. It's a really nice, clean, bright spaceship setting, isn't it? And looks good. Very good. It's quite an interesting moment comes up now, doesn't it, that any fans of Blake 7 would enjoy. And that's the voice of Peter Tudnam, who, of course, does all the computer voices in Blake 7, Zen, Aurak, and Slave. And he uses a kind of proto-Aurak voice, doesn't he, in this case? As the Doctor and Harry get to a sliding door, which is the entrance to a sterile area, and this Aurak voice comes out warning them this, and it's as grumpy sounding as Aurak is.
It's bizarre, isn't it? You know, this is a sterile area. Keep out. Very strange tone for a machine voice, sort of thing.
Well, it is, yeah, particularly when you have all these kind of fairly mellifluous tones in the room that Sarah's in, you know, when she's going through the processing. Although the voice of the High Minister sounds a bit like a rather sort of pumped up vicar. Very portentous tones, aren't they? But yeah, this is quite a surprise. And it's the only time that voice is heard during the story, isn't it?
It is. And despite the obvious warning, they ignore it and open the door and move on.
Well, naturally.
And as soon as they go through, Harry sees something moving up ahead. And you get a glimpse of this kind of green thing that disappears into sort of the ducting at the side of the corridor, don't you? Don't you get a view from this creature looking back at Harry as well?
Yeah, you get a little point of view shot, don't you, with the green surround, as you saw right at the beginning of the programme. But yeah, they see this green sort of snail trail, don't they, heading to this grill in ducting. And as the grill is undisturbed, the Doctor decides it must be a multi-nuclear organism. You know, obviously it can kind of split its way through and then rejoin the other side of his grill, which is nice. They then go into decontamination chamber, and in a way this is where the kind of story begins, isn't it? Because they find this cryogenic repository, all these banks of microfilm, rather quaintly, in the far-flung future, which has a complete record of the music, history, literature, architecture and engineering of Earth. And, you know, this is the meat and potatoes of the story, isn't it?
Exactly. Harry's sort of refers to it, he thinks it might be some sort of survival kit. And the Doctor turns to him and says, "You're improving, Harry. Your mind's beginning to work." Entirely due to my influence, of course. He doesn't take any credit.
Yeah, I love this.
Great.
Yeah, he doesn't often get a compliment from the Doctor, and even when he does, it's rather backhanded, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
But the Doctor obviously agrees that it does appear to be a kind of survival kit, but you know, there's obviously one missing ingredient, and that's the people. And as they mention that, a door slides open, and you see these galleries of body pallets, don't you? Most of them containing bodies. It turns out to be a cryogenic chamber.
Yeah, it's a pretty impressive set, actually, I think.
Very impressive, yeah.
Yeah, I think it looks really good. We now get the famous Tom Baker Homo sapiens speech, don't you? Which is marvellous.
Yeah, it's superb. We'll give that a listen now.
Homo sapiens. What an inventive, invincible species. It's only a few million years since they crawled up out of the mud and learned to walk. Puny, defenseless bipeds. They've survived flood, famine and plague. They've survived cosmic wars and holocausts. Now, here they are, out among the stars, waiting to begin a new life, ready to outsit eternity. They're indomitable. Indomitable.
But interestingly, Harry's in the other room, isn't he, He's opened up a pallet and is pretty convinced that the person inside is as dead as a door knocker. The doctor's in the other room making his indomitable speech, isn't he? But apparently to himself, as Harry's not in the same room as him. But it's a fabulous speech, isn't it? It's one of the most stirring speeches in the show's history, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it's brilliant.
He's got the voice to deliver it, of course, Tom Baker.
Oh, yeah. So, yes, Harry's inspecting one of the humans, thinks they're dead, as you just said. But the doctor's saying, oh, no, they're in sort of total suspension. You know, they could have been there for like 10,000, 50,000 or 100,000 years, which, you know, is a fair old time, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Harry wonders that they might be in a coma, but of course, you know, hair and nails and all that kind of stuff grow and, you know, you're not going to last that long in a coma any longer than you would if you were awake. But, yeah, the doctor's saying this is total suspension, so, you know, time is immaterial, really, as long as the systems keep working.
Mm.
And he wonders, you know, if there was some kind of global catastrophe on Earth which caused, you know, this whole sort of life raft situation.
Mm.
Sadly, they find another green snail trail leading up to one of the pallets. And then, more shockingly, Harry opens another pallet elsewhere in that room and finds Sarah in it.
Yeah, it's quite surprising. The doctor's worried that they might be too late and that she's going to be there for at least a few thousand years, doesn't he, before she can be resuscitated. But Harry's, you know, doesn't want to give up, and he goes off looking for a resuscitation unit, which the doctor's referred to. So, you know, what does one look like? He said, well, it looks a bit like an oxygen cylinder. So he starts opening some of the cupboards. He opens one cupboard, there's nothing in there, and then he opens another, and lo and behold, this big green monster falls out at him, and the episode ends.
Yeah, it's a big old insect lurches out at
him. Yeah, it just kind of falls towards him. And... you know, you still hear the doctor sort of talking away to himself as this happens. Yeah, a pretty good opening episode, I thought.
Yeah, it scared me witless when I watched that first time, because I remember it when it was screened, this one, and I would have been about just coming up to seven. And, yeah, that absolutely terrified me when this huge insect lurched out of the cupboard. There's a slight moment of bathos, isn't there, at the other end, because it's clearly extremely dead and no one even seems particularly concerned about it. The doctor and Harry just kind of look at it, and Harry says it's dead, and the doctor says very dead, almost mummified. And then they say, well, we haven't got time to look at this, we've got to concentrate on Sarah, so they're immediately on to the next thing. So it's whilst it's an excellent cliffhanger, its resolution is rather swift. And
What surprised me is that Harry just takes it in his stride.
That's what I mean, really, yeah.
This is his second story, isn't it? He was introduced in Robot, and the most he would have come across in Robot was a giant robot. And yet, here he is, face-to-face with a giant, you know, space wasp, and he doesn't even bat an eyelid, which seems a bit odd.
Yeah, it kind of adds to the sort of underwhelming resolution to the cliffhanger, really, isn't it? No one seems that bothered with it.
Anyway, meanwhile, the one of the pallets things, the light starts flashing. There's a couple of lights at the bottom, and they start flashing. And the doctor, Mary, notices this, and, you know, one of the humans is starting to resuscitate, which it turns out to be Vyra, played by Wendy Williams. And Harry's found a medical kit in one of these cupboards. You can't make head or tail of, you know, what you're supposed to do with it. But he's standing there holding it while Vyra's coming round, and she kind of sticks her arms out, doesn't she? You know, he offers this medical kit up to her, and she takes this kind of little ball thing and puts it in this gun and then shoots herself in the heart with it.
Yeah, it seems to be a sort of futuristic syringe, doesn't it? But you do wonder what would happen if the doctor and Harry hadn't been standing there with the medical kit when she got revived. Because she would have got out of the pallet, walked over, picked up this medical kit, and then performed that operation.
Mm.
Because, you know, she seems to be the programmed to be the first one to be revived. So, yeah, it does make you wonder what happened if they hadn't been there.
They should have revived many, many centuries ago, shouldn't they? And you don't really know what the impact of the Wirren being there and all the systems not kicking in when they were supposed to have done. It may be that it wouldn't have happened quite like that.
Yeah, it's possible that procedure isn't required normally. If everything's running properly, yeah, you're right. So, yeah, just so happens that they're around for this, but normally that wouldn't be required. So, yeah, let's leave it at that. The doctor and Harry announce themselves to her because she seems quite shocked to see them on Nerva, And from the names, of course, she wonders if they're med techs. And then the doctor says that fabulous line, doesn't he? He says, well, my doctorate is purely honorary, and Harry here is only qualified to work on sailors. Superb.
It is superb. So anyway, they ask her for some help to revive Sarah, and Vyra's kind of, she doesn't seem too keen to help them at first. She sort of says, you know, is she of any worth or something? And they're both like, well, yes, she is. So she kind of puts this crown thing on her head, doesn't she? Mm. Which kind of reads the neural activity in her brain and decides that it's probably worth a go to try and revive her. She puts these little ball things that she refers to as a monod block, doesn't she, or something? Mm. Puts it into this gun, and then on this occasion she fires it into her wrist rather than over the heart. Mm. And then she says, well, you know, she'll either recover or she'll die.
That's a nice kind of covers all bases, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, all right, 50-50 chance.
It's nice that there's a slight communication problem, isn't there, between Vyra and the Doctor and Harry. Harry uses some slang, doesn't he? I think he says, that injection, will it do the trick? Mm. And she doesn't understand what he's talking about. She talks about their colony speech being very difficult to understand. And she also calls them dawn timers, which is a nice sort of sci-fi name, I think.
Yeah, so lots of nice touches, really. Meanwhile, another of the humans is starting to defrost. And this one is Noah, who's the kind of the leader of the humans. Vyra refers to him as the prime unit or something, doesn't he?
That's right, yeah.
When she sort of says it's Noah, you know, Harry says, like, oh, you know, as in Noah's Ark sort of thing. And she sort of says, yeah, we called him Noah for an amusement.
Yeah, so his real name's Lazar, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because that's kind of like the root of Lazarus. It's also, you know, a great awakening. So yeah. He's got two sort of biblical names there, isn't he, really? It's interesting that she seems quite fond of him, doesn't she? She sort of strokes his face, doesn't she, when she's over the pallet. And later we find out why she's fond of him. And she starts talking about the last days. And she said, yeah, there weren't many jokes in the last days. They obviously don't know what the last days are, and she can't understand how the colony they come from, which she assumes, could not be aware of what happened. And she certainly can't believe Harry's claim that he's from Earth, as all life has been destroyed by solar flares. And according to, you know, their scientists, they thought it would take about 5,000 years for the biosphere to become viable again. So Harry is an anomaly as far as she's concerned.
Mm. The Doctor tells her that, you know, they've overslept by several thousand years. You know, obviously the influence of the Wirren has set them back by quite a while. There's something that's kind of niggled me about this story is this length of time. The opening shot when the Wirren is on the ship and it gets killed, presumably that is a long time in the past. That would be when they were still set to resuscitate after 5,000 years.
Yeah, that must be before the scheduled alarm clock, isn't it?
Hmm. So, since then and now, several thousand years have passed. Why is it taking the Wirren so long to gestate?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, clearly, the Wirren they find in the cupboard, you know, is the one that got shot, isn't it, in the beginning, that we see at the beginning of the programme. And that one, as the Doctor says, is almost mummified. So that bit's okay, that works. But... Mm. There's this Wirren grub sliming its way around the Ark, isn't it? Yeah, what's that been doing for the last few thousand years?
Well, we'll get to it in a little bit, I guess, but the dead Wirren obviously laid eggs in June, and you would think that that would have happened quite quickly. I mean, is it several thousand years for the gestation period? It doesn't seem to be, because as things progress, it seems to be quite quick.
Mm.
But anyway, maybe talk about that at the end, but it doesn't quite add up, all of that bit, I don't think.
No, it doesn't. But then we have a look down into the dark solar stack room, don't we? The Wirren grub is moving about, and then it appears to have rather quickly developed an eye and a vestigial arm, doesn't it? Because it then goes up and opens its hatch.
Yeah.
We saw it was very much, you know, a limbless, eyeless slug, wasn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't look particularly good when it's kind of crawling around. It's a bit like a man in a sleeping bag.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because having watched this programme when we were kids, every time we went up to our cousins in Suffolk or anywhere else where we slept in sleeping bags, we used to charge around the room in our sleeping bags pretending we were Wirren grubs. I was 19.
We used to do a similar thing with pretending to be Fendal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very similar. happy days, eh?
Yeah, definitely.
I haven't done that for several weeks now.
Well, maybe we could, you know, meet up and do it together. Great.
I don't like the sound of that much.
Neither do I, actually. I didn't come out as I expected. Anyway, yes, so we see this Wirren grub wandering around down in the power room. Yeah, the doctor's telling Vyra that they've had this visitor. He shows her the body of the dead Wirren. Unfortunately, as Noah is starting to resuscitate, a fault develops, doesn't it, in the main power supply, presumably due to what this Wirren grub has been doing down below. So the doctor says, oh, you know, he'll go and change it to the backup power in the control room. So he goes off, leaving Vyra and Harry. And then you hear him calling over the tannoy that he's going to go down and check the main solar stack where he thinks the fault is. So off he goes. Vyra, in the meantime, has revived Noah, and he is very upset to see Harry there, isn't he? And he refers to him as a regressive, and he's actually quite nasty, isn't he?
Quite aggressive to the regressive, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
He's very worried about the genetic pool being messed up by these visitors. Of course, that only happens if they start mating with them, doesn't it?
Well, maybe he thinks that Harry's been hitting on Vyra, perhaps.
Maybe he does.
But yeah, interesting, because this whole theme runs throughout the whole story, doesn't it? The idea of messing with genetics. And I think it's a real well-constructed story, apart from the little niggles I've mentioned already. You know, it's pretty good stuff.
Yes. They find out that Sarah's going to be fine, and Vyra sets about reviving her. Meanwhile, the doctor finds one of these green trails in the solar stack room. And while this is happening, the rather aggressive Noah has visited the armory. And Vyra says that Noah, as the prime unit, has the authority to take Condyne action if anything starts to threaten the project. So that doesn't look good for the doctor.
Mm. Vyra revives Sarah by giving her a shot in the heart again. Vyra advises Harry that they ought to leave because Noah's not going to allow any contaminated regressives to interfere with their future. She says, you know, in her opinion, she doesn't think that their destruction is necessary, which is quite nice. Meanwhile, back down in the solar stack, the doctor has found something nasty in the machinery, hasn't he? There's this sort of horrible green glow coming out of sort of glass cover to the solar stack. And there's, you know, this eye looking back at him.
Yes, foul, isn't it?
Yeah, he has a look at it and then decides to beat a retreat.
Harry, by this time, has filled Sarah in about what's going on, and he shows her the dead Wirren. But at this point, Vyra absolutely freaks out because she finds that the dune isn't in his palate.
I actually loved this bit where Harry shows Sarah the Wirren, and, you know, Sarah's going, oh, what is it? And Harry just goes, don't know, just found it in a cupboard. It just sums him up. It's like some kind of laid back about it. You know?
Yeah, like some old copy of Razzle or something. Very strange. Meanwhile, Noah finds the doctor back in the control room. The doctor's trying to shut down the solar stack, so obviously Noah's not too pleased about that. And he immediately says, yeah, what are you doing? Earth is ours, which is a phrase that gets sort of reflected a little bit later on in the show, doesn't it? The doctor says there's something trapped in the solar stack, and at the rate it's absorbing energy, it won't be trapped for long. And Noah kind of smiles evilly and then just shoots him with his stun gun, doesn't he?
And shoots him in mid-sentence.
In mid-sentence, yeah, and as that happens, you see the creature, as promised, breaking out of the solar stack.
Mm. Yeah, Noah calls Savara over the tannoy, and she tells him that June is missing. So that, for him, sort of solidifies his view that the regressives are responsible for it, and that they're sort of the ones that are up to no good. He tells her that he's going to go and check on the power stack. So he goes down there. Unfortunately, while he's there, he gets attacked by one of the grubs. He shoots at it, but it kind of manages to slime him, doesn't it? Touches his hand, and he, you know, he's obviously in some sort of pain, and he collapses. Harry and Sarah find the doctor unconscious in the control room. He comes round, finishing the sentence that he'd been saying when he got shot. And he sort of says, I was cut off in mid-sentence. I might have been saying something important. I was saying something important.
Great Tom Baker moment, though.
Yeah, it is. Noah's come round downstairs, and he sort of heads back along the corridor back towards the control room as the Doctor, Sarah and Harry are walking the other way, and they kind of come across each other. He's got his hand in his pocket for obvious reasons.
Yeah, his left hand is out of view, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's another cracking fourth Doctor bit, isn't there? With Noah's pointing a gun at them and he tells them to return to the cryogenic section. And the Doctor says, "You're absolutely right, there's no time to lose, come on." As if it's his idea.
Yeah, exactly. So back at the cryogenic section, Vyra's there, she's been reviving some more humans. One of them is a chap called Libri, who on seeing Noah is absolutely horrified by something. You know, he's obviously seeing something other than Noah. He's kind of going, get back, keep away, which kind of thing. Vyra's sort of saying, well, you know, what's the matter with you? It's Noah. And then he sort of comes around and says, oh yeah, it's fine. But he's obviously seen a shadow of what's to come.
Yeah, in his kind of sort of recently woken state, he's somehow seen something in Noah that isn't right. Vyra puts it down to temporary neuro-ocular confusion. The Doctor's quite interested in what Libri's seeing, but Noah won't let Libri describe what's happened.
Mm. But it's soon clear that there is something up with him, because he tells Vyra to stop the revivification process. Easy for me to say. And she sort of questions him as to why, you know, why would they stop it? And he says, it's an order, I'm the commander. The plan's changed. And he's saying it in a kind of a voice, he's obviously, there's something going on in his head. And they kind of argue a little bit, but she mentions June, doesn't she? You know, June's missing. And he says, June? But I'm here, I am June. and then sort of rushes off, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's quite a creepy moment. He smiles and he says, I'm Dune. And then he seems to have another brainstorm, doesn't he? And he orders the system to be shut down again, revivification system, and says, no more humans, quite tellingly.
Mm.
Scuttles off. And after a little bit of persuasion, the Doctor gets Libri to go after him with his gun.
Yeah, he's actually quite strong at this point, isn't he? At times, Tom Baker can up the ante when he's talking, and you know, he really comes across as a strong character. You know, yeah. Believe must be stopped. The way he delivers that line, it's kind of classic.
Yeah,
Baker.
Yeah, it is. He's very commanding, isn't he? And then people just end up doing what he says, and as a result, yeah. The Doctor has a look at Dune's palette and sees this green trail to it, and puts two and two together. And he starts kind of working out what's happened. He thinks that the Wirren that they found in the cupboard was the progenitor, the queen colonizer. Checks her egg tube and finds out it's empty. And he reckons that the Wirren might be like a species of Earth wasp, which lays its eggs inside a host's body so that when the young hatch, they have something to feed on. You know, since they're born, which is a really obscene sort of idea, isn't it?
It's absolutely horrific, really. You know, I mean, as the Doctor says, it's almost too horrible to think about.
And you think of all that food source just there, nicely refrigerated, fresh, ready for the Wirren young. It's just horrible, isn't it?
Mm. What did slightly annoy me about this bit was that why have they left it this long to realise that that's happened? Because as soon as you go into the cryogenic chamber and you see the green slime trail leading from the grill to Dune's palate, they look at the trail, but they don't think that it leads to that pallet until this point, do they?
No, they're talking about it might be some kind of mould, don't they?
Yeah. Why do they leave it so long to have a look inside? It seems daft. But anyway.
There are the empty pallets, aren't there, you can see around, but yeah, there aren't any with trail leading up to them. It's dramatic license again, isn't it? It's just the way the plot has to work, but yeah, you're right. And the Doctor twigs that as June was the power systems technician, he worked out the Queen must have got some knowledge of the Ark when she attacked June in his palace, because she knew exactly where to go to start sabotaging the systems.
Mm.
So that's quite a horrible idea. Not only are they eating these humans, they're also absorbing the knowledge.
Exactly. We're approaching the end of the episode again here, aren't we? Noah confronts Libri and manages to convince him to give him the gun that he's aiming at him. Of course, as soon as he takes the gun off of him, he shoots him.
It's quite an amusing death of Libri, don't you think?
Yeah, he kind of falls back with his arms stretched out, doesn't he?
Yeah, it reminds me of that bit at the beginning of John Pertwee's Wurzel Gummidge series, where Wurzel Gummidge kind of gets himself up on the sort of crucifix seat, and then just falls backwards with his arms outstretched, and that's exactly how Lee regards it, which takes a little bit of the tension out of the situation.
Yeah.
And then we get to a very iconic moment, don't we?
Yeah, indeed we do. So Noah slowly takes his hand from his pocket to reveal it's covered in green bubble wrap.
That's true. Yeah.
And he looks at it aghast,
yeah,
thinking to himself, hey, surely they're going to come up with a better effect than this. No, it's actually quite good. I mean, looking at it now, it's quite clear what it is, but it still looks reasonably good, and they're not afraid to show it in close-up.
The thing is, looking at it from our standpoint now is different, isn't it? Because bubble wrap is very widely seen, isn't it?
Mm.
It was a very new product back then, and as a seven-year-old, I didn't get involved in packing materials very much. So I didn't know that it was anything like that. To me, it was just a horrible mutated hand. It's quite horrible, isn't it? And if anything, it's more effective when it's on the Wirren grubs, because it looks, like the little sucker things you get on an octopus's tentacles. It's got that sort of look to it, hasn't it?
And
I think it works really well, because it's a kind of larger bubble wrap, isn't it, rather than the small bubbles. It is good. It is immediately obvious that it's bubble wrap now, but it's still a good effect, and it's certainly a good effect then.
Mm, definitely. So, it's part three. Yeah, it kind of opens with the Earth High Minister giving a resounding speech to the troops, doesn't it? Mm. Or as Harry calls it, a pre-match pep talk.
Yeah.
I don't know what kicks this off. I don't know if it's just part of the revival process or whatever, but suddenly you get this kind of resounding speech, and everyone stops and listens to it, and you've got Noah still holding his hand up, kind of listening, and the Doctor and all the others kind of stop everything while this is going on.
I wonder if it's something that's kicked in. Three people have been revived now. I wonder if they think, that's a quorum and it's time to start the thing off. Yeah, it's not clear why it happens exactly then. But it does seem to have an effect on Noah, doesn't it? He seems to kind of regain himself a little bit and start smashing his infected hand onto the control console, doesn't it?
Yeah, he does, and he kind of then has a bit of a cliched fight with his own hand, doesn't he? It seems to have a life of its own. His other arm is holding it back. And it's a bit over the top, I think.
It's a bit Marcel Marceau.
Yeah. This bit with Noah, once he's been taken over, borders on the overacting, doesn't it, really? He does tread a fine line with it.
Yeah, I'd say it borders on it, but I think he gets away with it. It's obviously quite a horrible experience for him, and that certainly comes across. I personally didn't think it was over the top, but it's close to it. But it's interesting that his vocabulary starts changing, doesn't it? First, he kind of, as the human Noah, he wants to speed up the revivification process, and don't worry about the safety checks because there isn't time. It's great danger. And then he tells her that she's now got a command and she's got to get the humans onto the Earth before the Wirren, which is the first time he heard the name mentioned.
Mm.
He doesn't finish the sentence there. But it's interesting that he starts changing we, talking about the humans, for you, and then our for your. So he's kind of beginning to think like a Wirren.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though he's still just about on the human side.
Yeah, lovely bit of 70s sexism from Harry, don't you? Fancy a member of the fairer sex being top of the totem pole.
So I doubt we're smiling when Thatcher took over. As none of the country was. But then the Wirren seems to take over completely, at least for this moment. And Noah says, we shall absorb the humans, the Earth shall be ours. And it's quite a chilling change, isn't it? Because he stops biting his hand and struggling to speak and just stands up straight and delivers this line, doesn't he?
Mm.
Very well done, I think.
Yeah. Although then he keeps switching from one to the other, because he then says that, they're in my mind getting stronger. He starts fighting with his arm again. The Doctor asks Vyra to come with him to speak to Noah, because he thinks that Noah will pay more attention to her. And he leaves Harry to revive the technicians and asks Sarah to give him a hand.
He calls her Nurse Smith, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Which he doesn't, not very keen on.
Yeah. Halfway along one of the corridors, the Doctor and Vyra come across one of the sliding doors, and as it slides up, Noah's there, and he's now kind of half-transformed. One side of his face and body are now covered in bubble wrap.
It's quite shocking, isn't it?
It is. It's quite grim. he's still got a gun, which is pointing at them. But the doctor sort of asks him when the adult phase is due, and Noah says it feels near. And then there's something strange happens here, because the camera cuts to looking at the Doctor and Vyra, and then you see the gun fall to the floor and the door's shut. Feels like there's a cut.
There is quite a heavy cut here, and it's explained in the info text. What actually was supposed to happen was that Noah's explaining that he's been taken over. It's fairly obvious he's been taken over. But he's saying he's in turmoil, and he begs Vyra to kill him. So that shot of the gun dropping to the floor is him dropping the gun for Vyra to pick up to shoot him. But Philip Hinchcliffe, of all people, decided that this scene was a bit too grim to have Noah begging Vyra to kill him. So it was decided that that scene would be truncated, basically. So they've reordered it slightly. So it looks, I suppose, like the door has slid shut, but it's knocked the gun out of Noah's hand or something, doesn't it? That's what you kind of deduce from what's left after the edit. But it was all about this scene that was considered too strong meat for the audience.
Right. Okay.
Just before this happens, he says a wonderful line about tearing free and in the great blackness rushing through, doesn't he?
Mm.
Which gets mentioned a little bit later. It's a kind of Wirren race memory, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Doctor and Vyra are visibly shaken by this confrontation with Noah, and Vyra then reveals that she and Noah were to be pair bonded for the future life ahead of them. And she looks quite sort of shocked and revolted, doesn't she? But I don't think he has to worry. I don't think anyone's going to still expect it to go through with it this time.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you have to. Maybe it's, one of the rules, future Earth. Once you're pair bonded, that's it.
Yeah, legally binding.
Yes. Anyway, Sarah and Harry have managed to revive a couple more of the humans. Rogin and Lysit. Rogin's quite an interesting character, isn't he? Very different to the other members of the human race that have been revived.
He's great, and all this talk of colony speak, I mean, he seems to have a fair amount of colony speak himself, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
He's talking about there's been a snitch up, and he's got his catchphrase is beautiful,
yeah,
which is quite unlike how any of the other humans speak. Isn't it?
Yeah, he's quite a colourful character. Lysit, on the other hand, is a bit wet.
Yeah, and looks like Jürgen Klinsmann. For those who don't know, a German footballer.
Yeah.
Rogan's played by Richardson Morgan, who actually played Corporate Blake in The Web of Fear.
Oh, okay.
Which I didn't know until reading the info notes. One of the things that recurs with Rogan is that he wishes that they actually taken the chances on Earth in the thermic shelters. Yeah, he revisits that idea a little bit later, quite an amusing line.
So Sarah and Harry are sort of explaining what's been going on, and Vyra and the Doctor return after their confrontation with Noah. We get a shot of a Wirren Grub shuffling along the corridor, don't we? It's quite a grotesque image as well. We sort of said about the looking a bit like a man in a sleeping bag, but they're actually quite impressive.
It turns out it's a stuntman Stuart Fell inside, but I thought it was a child. It looks quite small. It doesn't really look very human, does it, the movement in there?
No.
I think it's done very well.
Yeah, so Harry and the Doctor have moved the mummified Wirren body into the sort of the main room, and the Doctor wants to dissect it to see if he can figure out its physiognomy. And Vyra and the other techs go to start the main phase. And again, you've got another example of the Doctor not really paying attention, because he's carrying on with what he's doing, and then he suddenly says, "What do they say? What are they going to do?" He tells her to wait because she reckons it will take about 4 days to revive everyone. But the Doctor says, well, the Wirren will be crawling through the Ark in the next couple of hours, so they need to deal with that.
Yeah, it's a quite horrible line, isn't it, about, it's kind of better if they die in their pallets rather than being alive and aware of what's happening to them.
Yeah, well, horrible. He's talking about the life cycle of the Wirren, and he's saying that there must be a pupal stage between the larval and the adult stage, and that the Wirren are likely to be dormant and therefore vulnerable during that pupal stage. They need to be quick and deal with them at that stage. Quite a good idea, really.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, when Rogan's aware of how everything's gone pear-shaped on the Ark, he says, we should have stayed on Earth. I like Earth. I like heat. I don't suppose he likes the kind of heat that comes from solar flares.
No. So yeah, Harry's been carving up the Wirren and has revealed its innards, which we don't actually see on camera. The Doctor's sort of commenting on the way it's constructed and deduces that it must actually live in space, only occasionally visiting a planet for food and oxygen.
Yeah, it's got enzymes in its system that recycle waste, don't they? So it can turn its carbon dioxide back into oxygen, which makes Wirren's green in more ways than one, doesn't it?
Exactly.
The Doctor then removes what appears to be the sort of cornea from one of the Wirren's eyes, doesn't he? And he lashes it up to the neural cortex amplifier in the adjoining room, believing that he should be able to see the final images that the Wirren saw before it died. So that way they might find out what actually killed it and work out what its weaknesses are. The Doctor decides that when this doesn't seem to work, that he needs to provide extra stimulation, and he very cheerily elects to connect his own cerebral cortex to this lash up with the Wirren's cornea, despite the fact it's extremely dangerous, and particularly the process is interrupted. And then Baker appears to flap a line, doesn't he? When Sarah protests that the Doctor's putting himself into danger, he says, "It's not just our existence that's at stake, it's the entire human race." He seems to dry halfway through that line and then remember the rest.
Yeah.
But an otherwise faultless display.
When they're talking about the danger of him being linked to this device, sort of saying it could burn out your brain. He goes, "Yeah, not only brain perhaps, but mine is exceptional."
Yeah, it's classic. He's very upbeat about this horrible procedure, isn't he? This huge,
he loves it. He's revelling in it.
But on a more somber note, he does give Vyra the gun and he tells her to use it on him if anything goes wrong when he joins his mind to the Wirren. But at that moment, Lysette and Rogan hear a noise and rush out. Actually, the procedure's already started and the Doctor's in some kind of pain, isn't he? And as we've said in the previous podcast, no one does pain like Tom Baker.
Exactly. So the Wirren grub has broken into the cryogenic chamber, isn't it, through one of the grills, and Lysette and Rogan, as you say, have gone to investigate, and Lysette manages to get caught by this grub. It comes out, it moves towards him fairly quickly, and he tries to hide in one of the pallets. But before he can get in there, it gets him. You don't see it, but you do see sort of Rogan's horrified face, and he kind of legs it out of the room.
Yeah, and Harry and Rogan rush up to get some fishing guns from the armory. Meanwhile, the Doctor's brain is obviously attached to this Wirren's cornea, and the screen is showing from the Wirren's point of view the actual opening footage at the beginning of episode one, isn't it?
Well, you see an extra little bit, don't you, where you see the Wirren being shot by the autoguard.
That's right, and then you see it opening the control panel where the Doctor found that sabotage at the beginning of episode one. You see it opening Dune's palette.
Yeah, and you definitely see Dune's eyes flickering at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, he obviously knows something's up. Yeah, Harry and Rogan are confronted by Noah, aren't they, when they go for these guns.
A horrible moment, isn't it, when Noah jumps out, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And you see him from behind, and he's a lot greener than he was before.
Yeah, and he's now got sort of one big Wirren eye, hasn't he, on the side of the head. Quite grotesque, really. They shoot him with these guns several times to force him back, and obviously the electrical charge or the shots from these guns knock him back, but they don't... they're not killing him, they're just forcing him backwards, and they force him back through a door, which then closes on him, so they're able to get away.
Back in the control room, this Wirren grub is forcing its way through the door. It's got itself upright and squeezing its way through the side of this door. Sarah disconnects the Doctor, and he wakes up and just keeps repeating the word Wirren, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And Vyra thinks, right, this is what the Doctor was warning her about, so she prepares to shoot him. But Sarah stops him, and the Doctor at this point snaps back to reality and says, "Is it time to get up?"
Yeah, Harry and Rogan get back, and they start shooting at the grub with their guns. Doctor kind of walks towards it. He seems mesmerised by it, doesn't he? So he's still kind of got this thing in his head, and kind of walks, and Sarah sort of jumps on him and pulls him back to prevent him from getting grubbed.
Yeah, and then he tells him to aim lower. And they start shooting at the Wirren grub's teats.
Yeah, it's got a rather horrible pink underbelly, hasn't it?
It's foul, man.
yeah, as you say, covered in some sort of teats. They managed to force it back into the room and then out through the grill through which it came. So, yes, so they managed to shoo it away. So, yeah, the doctor's sort of recounting what he saw when he was linked up to this machine, and he said it was the auto guard that killed the Wirren. And Harry said, but, yeah, we found it in the cupboard. He said, you know, it must have had amazing willpower. It managed struggling on against death until its task was done. Which adds a bit of depth to the character, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So the Doctor thinks, well, we can use electricity against the Wirren, so why not electrify the infrastructure of the Ark? And there's a conversation about how long that's going to take, and also the fact that the Wirren now have Dune's knowledge of the Ark. But the Doctor thinks Dune may not have known everything about the systems on the Ark, and he wonders whether Dune would have known that these transmat beds can be reversed. And Rogan thinks this is an excellent idea, so the Doctor nominates him to go first.
Yeah.
He didn't seem quite so pleased about it.
He goes, yeah, and as you appreciate it, you can go first, and then Rogan's face drops, doesn't it?
So he gets up onto the bed that we saw Sarah transmatted through earlier, and he's sent through, and Harry goes next. But just as Sarah's about to go, the lights dim and the power fails, isn't it?
Mm.
They contact Rogan at the other end of the transmat, and he identifies the problem as being in the secondary stack. The Doctor has also noticed that the air supply has been cut off, and he thinks, oh yeah, well, the Wirren pupae don't actually need it. They don't need oxygen at this stage in their life cycle. So the Doctor rushes off to the secondary stack.
To go and turn the power back on, presumably.
Yeah.
So yeah, when he gets to the room, you see several of these chrysalids around the room. The Doctor sort of has a look at one, and he stretches his arm out, doesn't he? And then probably thinks, well, hang on, maybe it's not a good idea to touch it. And then he sort of turns to the power stack, and you hear this kind of scuttling noise, and he looks up to see a full-grown Wirren approaching. And you get a close-up of its face, and it's still the vestiges of Noah's face as it finally transforms into an entire Wirren.
You sort of see Noah's face superimposed on the head of the Wirren, don't you?
It's, mm.
I'm not sure it's a wholly successful effect, but it lets you know that that Wirren is the one that used to be Noah.
As you say, it's not entirely satisfactory, but it does the trick.
Mm. Yeah, that's the end of the episode. And quite a horrible cliffhanger to see the Doctor, because the Wirren is between the Doctor and the door, for one thing, isn't it?
Mm. But luckily, Vyra comes to the rescue, and she shoots at the Noah Wirren, which, as it kind of falls back, the Doctor manages to get past it and up and out of the room. But as they turn to run, Noah calls out to Vyra. He asks her to abandon the Ark in the transport ship, or they're all going to die. Mm. So you're still getting vestiges of Noah's consciousness there, aren't you? He's not entirely gone, even though his body is completely gone.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? He's still clinging on to some humanity, isn't he? And then, very interestingly, he says that if she and the others don't escape, they'll be hunted down and destroyed as the humans destroyed the Wirren.
Mm.
And Sarah kind of protests that, you know, they never did that. But he then goes into this quite chilling speech, doesn't he, about the star pioneer humans earlier on in human history had gone out into what the Wirren calls their old lands. And the humans fought the Wirren for 1,000 years and ended up destroying the Wirren breeding colonies, driving the Wirren from Andromeda and leaving them drifting in space. But the Wirren need terrestrial breeding colonies. They used to use senseless cattle in the old lands as their hosts, but the Noah Wirren says they'll now use the humans in suspended animation. And by absorbing all the human knowledge, they'll become a technologically advanced race sort of overnight. All their succeeding generations will have all the Earth's knowledge.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because as we see a bit later, the other Wirren don't appear to be able to speak, do they? They communicate in some sort of kind of chittering noise, don't they?
Mm.
So it's only because of the fact that they've taken over Noah that they've got all his knowledge and obviously his ability to communicate.
It makes you wonder what will happen to, you know, Noah's progeny, because they, you know, will have the knowledge and maybe they'll have, you know, the ability to speak or not. It doesn't matter to this story, but it may be just because they're a vestige of Noah in this Wirren that allows that one to speak to the humans.
Yeah. So they beat a retreat, don't they? As some of the other pupae start to hatch, some of the other Wirren start to emerge, and they head back to the control room. And then we get the first, the very famous line from Tom Baker. Anyone for a jelly baby?
Yes.
And he offers jelly baby to Vira and the others.
There's a nice line from Rogan, I think, before they turn up. Obviously, the lights are dimmed, aren't they, because of what's happened in the solar state. And Rogan said, after what happened to Lysa, I want to see where I'm putting my feet.
Yeah.
And then Harry, obviously in socks, says, you should worry.
Yeah. Yeah, Harry says, you know, why don't they leave in the TARDIS? But the Doctor gives a half-hearted excuse as to why they can't do that. Although he doesn't want to leave the sleeping humans to the Wirren, does he?
No.
He says, you know, and I'm sure Vira won't want to leave them either. So he's sort of saying, you know, what we need to do is send high-voltage power through the bulkheads so that that will put up a barrier so that they can then try and formulate a plan.
Yeah, and it protects the sleeping humans, doesn't it, from the Wirren?
Yeah, exactly. But obviously that's only kind of a short-term solution. But of course they haven't got any power and the Wirren have got control of the power stack, so how are they going to, you know, manage to do this? And while the Doctor is speaking to Vira about this plan, Ceres, she's trying to butt in saying, well, you know, I've got an idea, but he's not having any of it and he's not listening to her. Mm-hmm. And when their discussion goes up a blind alley, he sort of turns to Sarah and says, what are you trying to say, Sarah? And she says, why don't we use the power from the transport ship?
Yes, well done.
Good old Sarah.
Four Granivox turbines.
Yeah, always useful, Granivox turbines. So they have a look at the plans of the Ark. They pull up on one of the monitor screens and they're trying to figure out how they're going to run the cables from the transport ship to the cryogenic chamber. And there's these conduits in between, isn't there, that are fairly narrow, but Sarah, being small, offers to squeeze through and take the cables herself.
Small and plucky.
Yes, definitely plucky.
Tom Baker's face at this point is absolutely hilarious when he's... He's looking at Sarah during this conversation. It's worth another look. It's just absolutely superb.
Yes. Vira, Rogan, Sarah and Harry head off to the transport ship to sort out the cabling at that end while the Doctor remains in the cryogenic chamber and he's wiring up the cables there. And a Wirren comes in through the sort of the outer chamber. The Doctor hears it approaching and he hides in one of the caskets as it comes in. And you get a typical Doctor Who cliche in that, you know, he starts to open the casket to have a look at it and the Wirren turns round and, you know, properly closes it.
Yeah, that's good. Back on the transport ship, just with a little bit of blue light, you automatically know that's a transport ship and not part of the Ark. It's just a nice piece of production work, I suppose, isn't it?
Mm.
Rogan's having a conversation with Vira and he kind of jokes that they could just fly to the Earth there and then in the transport ship and leave all this nastiness behind them. But, she sort of pulled in the face and you know, they don't. It appears he was only joking. Mm. But they've given Sarah a headset and he starts giving her instructions from the transport ship to help her navigate through this ducting to meet up with the Doctor in the cryogenic chamber. He warns her that at one point during her passage she's going to head into the part of the infrastructure where they're wearing a hatching. This she duly does, and this Wirren appears to look straight at her through a grill, doesn't it?
Mm.
She just kind of stifles a scream and struggles on past it, but that thankfully doesn't appear to mount to anything further than that.
You know, it's obviously aware that she's there and it's kind of menacing her, isn't it, and sort of scratching at this sort of grill. It's quite a horrible image, really. Mm. She gets to about 15 metres from the end, and the Doctor can hear her coming and he sort of calls her on, and she gets stuck and he's kind of shining a torch at her. He says, well, you know, just back up a bit and, you know, try again. And she goes, oh, no, I'm stuck. And starts whining a bit, doesn't she? And the Doctor basically tells her to stop whining, girl. You're useless. And has a real go at her. And so there's hundreds of lives at stake and you lie there blubbing.
We should never relied on you.
Yeah, which, of course, this spurs her on, which is obviously what the Doctor was trying to achieve. And she manages to get out, and the Doctor sort of helps her out, pulls her out by her arms, doesn't he? And he sort of turns it completely around and says, I'm really proud of you.
She realises she's been conned.
Yeah, conned again, you're a brute.
Yeah, excellent stuff. So the Doctor connects up the cable and tells Sarah to close the door to the control room, the adjoining room. She finds a Wirren in that room. She manages to close the door just before the Wirren gets through. And the Doctor throws a switch on the power and the Wirren against the door gets a mighty electric shock, doesn't it? And he starts twittering violently and staggers off.
Yeah, this was a bit I was alluding to earlier. You know, that kind of squeaking, isn't it?
Mm.
And then it goes off and it comes back with some others, and they're all kind of squeaking to each other, twittering or chittering, whatever you want to call it. So it's obviously not Noah. Although it might be Noah, I suppose, because he'd probably chitter away to them as well, wouldn't he?
Yeah, at this point we don't know which is which to me. They're messing outside the cryogenic chamber, and then Sarah elects to wander over and stand next to one of the grills, doesn't she? Weirin appears and tries to drag her through. And the doctor, as already mentioned, he'd left a kind of free-lying cable there from the power supply, and he grabs it and pokes it, this Weirin, and fries it.
So, yeah, they're kind of more or less just sort of sitting around for a bit, aren't they, on the floor? Well, they're waiting to see what the Weirin are going to do next. Mm. And the Weirin turn the power back on for some reason. I guess it's just so that they can talk to them, isn't it? Because Noah calls Tavara over the Tannoy thing, doesn't he?
Mm.
So I presume that's why they've turned the power on. And he says, your resistance is useless. But he offers them safe passage from the Ark, and guarantees their safety if they'll just leave, you know, the sleepers, as he refers to them. But of course, the Doctor refuses. Yeah, he actually refuses on Vara's behalf, doesn't he? He doesn't want Vara speaking directly to Noah, does he? I guess he feels that...
Yeah, he might turn her somewhere, yeah.
Yeah.
But, so they threaten to turn off the oxygen. But the Doctor's trying to reason with the human vestige of Noah, reminding him about the Earth.
Noah, listen to me. If there's any part of you that's still human, if you've any memory of the man you once were... Leave the Ark. Lead the swarm into space. That's where the Weirin belong, Noah. Not on Earth. Not where you were born. Remember the wind and the sun, the fields, the blue sky? That's Earth, Noah. It's for the human race. Don't abandon it.
I have no memory of the Earth.
Yeah, that's quite chilling, isn't it? It's pretty much all Weirin by this stage. Back in the transport ship, they notice from the scanners that the Weirin are collecting below. Vara is quite troubled by what she's heard Noah saying, and she sort of kind of just goes through the motions, doesn't she, and sort of calmly tells Rogan to use one of the rocket boosters to blast the Weirin below.
Yeah, and they disappear. And the next thing we see is the Weirin, they're spacewalking around the Ark. They managed to get into the cargo hold of the transport ship. Mm. What did you think of that effect, you know, when they're kind of going outside of the ship?
I thought it was pretty awful, to be honest.
They did look very insect-like, that. That's the only good thing I thought about it. You know, they're kind of scuttling along, aren't they?
Yeah, it's one of those things, though. The little puppet things they made, the little models, there's no leg movement or anything in them, is there? It reminds me of a little scene in the Quatermass in the pit, you know, the TV version. And the effect isn't really that much better than it was then, and that was in the 50s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
One of those things that, you know, you just grin and bear, I think. But it's a nice idea, the spacewalking around the Ark.
Mm.
And getting in from that way, you know, rather than from inside.
Yeah, well, Rogan says that, you know, he thinks it looks like it's the entirety of the Weirin force that's gone into the cargo hold, which is quite handy, because... The Doctor sort of tells Rogan to cut the power and to evacuate the ship. He says just to set the controls to take off, doesn't he?
Yeah, automatic takeoff. So, yeah, the Doctor realises, you know, this ship is primed for takeoff, so he and Sarah run out and they meet up with the others below the transport ship. You see Rogan leaving the transport ship and he kind of pauses meaningfully, doesn't he, at the top of the ladder and then descends, and we find out fairly shortly what he's thinking about. And so he and the Doctor start deactivating the locks that are holding the ship in place on the side of the Ark. There's one lock left, and they start arguing about who's going to do it, because it seems like it's a pretty fatal job to be the last one. And the Doctor says he's going to do it, but Rogan knocks him out and makes a joke about he can't do that, trouble with the Union. So he knocks the Doctor out and bundles him away to safety. And sure enough, the ship takes off and Rogan gets blasted by the rockets underneath.
Yes, so he sacrifices himself to save the others.
Mm.
Good old
Good
boy.
Man. Yeah. What a hero.
So, yeah, you see the ship take off from the Ark and, you know, Vara and Sarah and Harry are watching this on a scanner in the control room. And they realise, well, they think that the Doctor and Rogan were both killed in the blast.
So Elizabeth Sladen as Sarah has to go into mourning mode, doesn't she? She does in virtually every story, doesn't she?
Yeah, so I think they just play that same scene with a different backdrop each time. But of course the Doctor appears. He says that he woke to find himself in a sort of a safe area where Rogan had put him. So they have to thank Rogan for his bravery. And the Doctor also says, and you know, maybe more than that, maybe the last vestiges of human spirit in Noah managed to make him draw all the Weren into the ship.
And sure enough, you see the transport ship on the scanner moving off to the distance, and then it explodes.
Before that, you get Noah's voice come over, you know, the radio, doesn't he? And he says, goodbye, Vira. And then you see the shuttle explode.
And Vira realises that he deliberately didn't set the rocket stabilisers.
Mm. Human spirit triumphing over the Weren's control. So, good stuff.
Yeah, great stuff. So Vira starts looking fairly happily, doesn't she? Looking forward to reviving her people, but realises now the transport ship's gone, that she'll have to use the transmat to get her people down to Earth.
Yeah, she doesn't seem too bothered about that. Noah's just blown himself up to save the human race. Her melancholy before is completely gone now, and she's quite in good spirits.
Yeah, well, perhaps she's a little bit proud of what he's done, and, you know, that's a bit of closure for her. He didn't just turn into a Weren and do something horrible. But, yeah, she realises they're going to have to use the transmat. The Doctor has a quick look at some of the controls and realises it's not working properly. So he volunteers to go down and fix it. And tells Sarah to get him something waterproof, because they don't know what the weather's going to be like after the solar flare activity. But Harry and Sarah both appear kitted up, don't they, and decide to come too. And the next stop is the Sontaran experiment.
It is. Why didn't they take the TARDIS down? Was it because they may not get where they're supposed to be going, do you think? Or,
I guess so, yeah. It's a little unreliable, isn't it? But on the other hand, it seems odd to trust three lives to this transmitter that doesn't seem to be working properly. I guess he just thinks it's a minor problem, and the quickest way to get to the controls is just use the transmat, and you know, you're right there in the right place in real time to just do the work when they get there. So yeah, maybe it doesn't look like too bad a fault.
But yeah, that's it. What do you think then? What's your overall thoughts of the Ark in Space?
Well, it's an absolute classic, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It really is absolutely superb. I think it's one of the, or perhaps the definitive spaceship story in Doctor Who.
Mm.
Yeah, it looks great as well, apart from, you know, the odd couple of 1970s effects don't work that well, but certainly the sets and all the cryogenic chamber and that corridor and everything else look really, really good. And I, for one, was pleased when they used all that stuff again and went back to Nerva for Revenge of the Cybermen later on in the season.
Mm.
I was just at that age where I loved all that kind of spaceship stuff. And of course, you didn't see a lot of that in the Pertwee era, what I can remember of it when I was quite young then, but so this is great to have a, you know, a really nice-looking spaceship and you know, all this horrific stuff going on and all that quite chilling sort of body horror of Noah's transformation. And the whole plot doesn't really let up.
No, it's pretty fast-paced, isn't it, all the way through, really.
Mm.
One of the things about the new series is, you know, it has to be so fast-paced. And you know, a lot of the time when you watch Old Who, you know, it's very noticeable that things don't move on very quickly. But, you know, plenty happens in this story.
Well, there doesn't feel like a lot of filler, does it? Or any, really. They nicely set the scene, and bits of information about the situation, you know, are discovered in a quite a nice and sort of timely way, aren't they? And you get a good kind of understanding of what's going on before things start to go horribly wrong. And it's good. The performances are good for everybody. I think Kenton Moore, is it, plays Noah. I think he's very good. He's quite menacing even before his transformation. And Wendy Williams as Vira is really good, and you know, Rogan's great, and the regulars are excellent, and they're really settled in supremely well, haven't they? I mean, it's Ian Marta and Tom Baker's third story by then, isn't it, in terms of recording?
Yeah.
But we've got a fully formed fourth Doctor, I think, by Ark in Space.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is noticeable that it is very early on. There's something in his performance that you can tell that he's not been doing it long. I'm not saying that in a bad way, but it doesn't quite seem as kind of relaxed into the role as he becomes. I couldn't work out whether it was that or whether it's the fact that he had a broken collarbone. And so his movement at times is a bit odd, and he holds himself a bit strangely in some of the scenes. I say he holds himself, his posture is a bit odd.
But luckily, he's in such a strange persona that stuff's not that obvious, I suppose. To be honest, I knew he'd broken his collarbone, but I hadn't noticed it affecting his performance in any way. But he was looking closer than I was. But he's such an odd character that it's kind of minor thing that you can just put down to characterisation rather than physical problems with the actor.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying there was anything wrong with this performance at all. I'm just saying that if you look at it, it just seems slightly different to, say, Genesis of the Daleks, that you would think, well, he's been doing this for years. Whereas, in fact, you know, it's probably the next story to be recorded in reality, isn't it? There's just something, I think, that you can tell it is very early on in the run.
Yeah, a great performance, nonetheless, as you say. Mm. I thought Sarah is good. I think Elizabeth Sladen is one of the best actresses, I think, for the companions, particularly in Classic Who. Mm. She's very believable in every situation, I think. And her, you know, looks of horror or things like that are delivered very naturalistically, I think. Katie Manning was great in a way, but as an actress, she's not a patch on Elizabeth Sladen, I don't think.
Mm. No, I think you're right. And, of course, Harry is great. Bumbling character. I love all his... the way he talks and how he refers to Sarah as old girl all the time, and it's just kind of stiff upper lip and all this kind of stuff.
It has been said, isn't it, because they didn't know the age of the Doctor that was going to be cast, and Ian Martin was already cast as Harry, you know, they were going to have this young character in to perhaps carry out physical stuff if we ended up with an older Doctor. And a lot of people said he came a little bit redundant because, you know, he had the youthful vigour of Tom Baker as the Doctor. I don't think he is redundant. I think he fits in very well.
Yeah, I agree, totally. It's a really good dynamic. Both Sarah and the Doctor kind of take the mick out of him ceaselessly, don't they, throughout? And he's always the brunt of their jokes and they kind of long-suffering looks that they both give him. But, yeah, I think it really works in this and other stories. Sadly, he was only there for one season. I think Terror of the Zygons was supposed to be part of this season, wasn't it? And for some reason they decided that they would hold that over to next year.
That's right, yeah. So that was his final story, wasn't it, Harry?
Yeah.
So he would have had one season and that would have been it, but he had turned out, you know, effectively one and a bit seasons, didn't he?
Yeah. He has a little cameo, doesn't he, in Android Invasion, but...
Yes, that's right, yeah. Yeah, he's a good character, you know, that kind of public school way of speaking and everything's amusing. And he provides, in what is quite a grim season, provides opportunity for comic relief without just being solely there for comic relief.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I like him. As you said, the sets were very good. I thought the full-grown Wirren costumes were excellent.
Yeah, there's an issue, isn't there, with how they actually get about, I think. You got all the legs up front, aren't they, and right at the top near the head. Mm. What happened in reality was that, you know, the actor's feet were shuffling about at the bottom out of shot. But it's a little difficult to see how the Wirren move about when in their fully grown state, isn't it? With all the legs at the top, which is the only downer I would put on that design, because, you know, the head and the body and everything are excellent, I think.
Yeah, but they're clever with it because they don't show the lower half, do they? Mm. So, you know, I still think they look good. I think the...
They seem to kind of waft about rather than walk, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. I think the grubs were less convincing at times, but also they could be quite horrific as well. I think it depended on the scene. And I guess it also depends on whether you can suspend your disbelief for a little bit with them.
Yeah, I think that is required. But certainly to a young kid like me, I couldn't see anything wrong with them at all. They were just absolutely terrifying.
Mm. So, oh, yeah, I mean, at the time, yeah, the same here. You know, of course, when you're looking at it now, you know, things like that show up much more.
Of course, yeah. But the transformation of Noah is really foul, isn't it?
Mm.
We don't see anything quite like that until Seeds of Doom again, I think, do we?
No.
Some alien entity physically taking over and mutating the body of a human is really unpleasant and very effective. Very well done.
Yeah, it's kind of nightmarish, isn't it? But yeah, absolutely wonderful story, I think. You know, the script is fantastic. We've picked on a little bits here and there, you know, just because we're looking at it in depth, but I think the whole thing really holds up.
It does. It's Robert Holmes, of course, is the absolute governor, isn't he, in terms of writing Doctor Who. He's my favourite by some stretch.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And this is just another brilliant, brilliant story by him.
Indeed.
It stands up pretty well today, I think, aside from the odd effect here and there. And it's interesting, having watched so much New Who of late, it's interesting how much simpler the programme was then, and much more direct, really, in terms of progressing the plot.
Yep.
there's not a lot of subtext there, but there are enough interesting ideas, and some of them quite horrific and thought-provoking in this particular story. It really focuses on the plot, doesn't it, with some nice characterization there, but the kind of emotional side of things is very much in the background. But it makes it feel like quite a different show, but I would like to think that anyone who enjoys New Who would enjoy The Ark in Space.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one, you know, if you're new to old Who, it's not a bad starting point, is it?
Oh, absolutely not, no. Very good.
So, yeah, highly recommended.
Yeah. We've got some feedback about The Ark in Space from our Facebook page. If you want to get to our Facebook page, either go to the blog page at crinoid.blog.co.uk and use the link on the top left of the page, or just go into your normal Facebook account and just search for Crinoid. That'll take you straight to our page. We've got some more input from Wayne Peters. He says, a proper body horror, just like Mummy used to make. Not Seeds of Doom, but still one of my favourites. Alien before Alien was thought of, which is an interesting point. Why did those space insects shuffle around on their bums instead of using their many legs? Also, the body horror that so horrified me as a child but turned out to be pop packing covered in green poster paint. Well, that's right, yeah, terrifying as a child, but yeah, you can see what everyday packing material they were made out. But I mean, as Wayne says, a great story. We've also got some comments from Mike Wenben. He says, I would have taken my chances with the solar flares rather than the flares on the jumpsuits on the space station, which is a good point. It's quite 70s clothing and hair style.
Yeah.
He says, certainly one of the camper points in the night sky. Good story, though. I remember the mock-up they had of the set in Madame Tussauds in the early 80s. Now, this was new to me, and I'm very jealous, because we never went to Madame Tussauds, because you know, you had to remortgage a house to go there. The interest fees are so terrifyingly high. So we never went, still haven't been, I don't think, to Madame Tussauds. And I wasn't even aware that they had this Ark in Space mock-up. That would have been fantastic.
It would have been. I wasn't aware of that either. Sounds like we've missed out there.
Yeah, we have. So thanks for that feedback. Look forward to more from those guys and anyone else. It's about time we scored this story, don't you think?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Shall I go first?
Go, you ahead, boy.
It's got to be a 9. It's cracking stuff. Maybe even a 10, but yeah, I'll go with 9. How about you?
Well, I'm in 2 minds as either to be, whether it's 9 or 10. If we have half, so I'll give it a 9.5. If we don't, I'd probably have to go 9, just because there's a couple of plot inconsistencies in the odd duff effect, but the overall story and production is magnificent, I think.
Yeah.
So it's almost maximum score, I think, however you look at it.
Yeah, it's up there with any of the best Doctor Who's ever, really. So, yeah, a pair of 9s.
Indeed it is, yes. Okay, so now is the time to choose what the next story we're going to look at in the Crinoid podcasts. The first person who offered a choice was Mike Doyle. As he came up first with something, I think we'll go with his suggestion, which is... The Five Doctors.
Excellent.
So, we've had a look at each of the, well, 7 Doctors, haven't we? But we've certainly looked at the 5 Doctors involved in 5 Doctors so far on the Crinoid podcast. So, you know, it's perhaps quite a good time to have a look at them all ganging up together. So, thanks, Mike, for that suggestion. And that's what we're going to be doing next. If you have any suggestions of stories you'd like to cover, again, head over to our Facebook page, because one of the discussions we've got there, in the discussion section, a few people have nominated stories they want us to have a look at. So the more ideas, the merrier. So yeah, head over there and let us know what you'd like to see us cover.
Cool, good stuff. I think, you know, with the ones we're going to be looking at over the next few months, we want to try and do a as broad a selection as we can, so we probably won't do another Tom Baker now for a few podcasts, will we? We're probably looking for other doctors first, I would think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, any kind of suggestions, and if we get people nominating stories more than once, then obviously it's more likely that we'll choose one of those.
Yeah, they'll move their way up the list, won't they?
Due
to popular demand. So yeah, keep those suggestions coming. it's less self-indulgent than the Martin and I just sitting here choosing the story what next, and this is really what the podcast is all about. So thanks for your input, and we look forward to more of it.
Exactly. It saves us having to decide, doesn't it? So
yeah, that's good. We find it difficult to rack up poor, meagre brains, don't we, Martin? That's, I guess, it for this podcast. So thanks very much for listening. You can get a hold of us at crinoid@mail.com, at crinoid.blog.co.uk, and as I say, at the Facebook page, and via Twitter, on which we are Crinoid. So we look forward to hearing from you in any or all of those different methods. And yeah, next time we're going to be looking at Five Doctors. So we look forward to your company then. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. See you next time.
BBC's Doctor Who programme. And no copyright infringement is intended!